Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. Each week on Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will Godzilla make an appearance? In this episode, writer and actor Brona C. Titley will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Titley has written on Spitting Image, Tracy Ullman's show, 8 out of 10 Cats, the stand-up sketch show, Celebability. She'll appear in ITV2's new comedy Buffering. She starred as a nun in Motherland. She didn't write on The MASH Report. And she's a celebrated stunt pilot. Brona C. Titley, welcome to Greenlit.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle, and also the soul and physical body of Toby Earle, I also believe is here.
In various ways, I believe it is. I think everything's attached currently.
Oh, I'm so pleased. That was the first thing I needed to check, actually, if everything was attached.
Was it?
So now that we have that kind of taken care of, then it's all business, isn't it?
Are you physically and spiritually ligament anchored?
Yes, my soul is partly here and then just partly in a Pizza Express somewhere, just because I really like pizza.
What pizza is your soul having in Pizza Express? Is there a favourite?
Now that we're giving this free press to Pizza Express right at the top of the show, I haven't been there in ages because of this. I don't know if you noticed it, there was a global pandemic. So I haven't been there in a while, but when I do go, I love those. I like caramelized onion and goat's cheese. Sure. Who doesn't? But I also, and this is going to sound sacrilege, I like those pizzas where they put the hole in the middle and put all the salad in, the Ligera, I think they're called. Because I think you can have pizza more often if you eat one with a bit of salad in the middle. You know, you can have kind of two pizzas a week then, as opposed to one pizza a week.
Could you not space out the salad eating throughout the week rather than have salad interfering with pizza or hollowing out a pizza?
I see what you're doing there and I respect you for it. But really my life revolves around knowing where the next pizza is coming from. And so I suppose I can justify having them more often if I'm having less pizza and more salad in the sitting, is my thinking.
Now, and that on that topic of pizza, 4 cheeses, quattro formaggi, is that not enough cheese on a pizza? Could there be more?
Yeah, I think there should be 18 cheeses. Like, I think, why 4? You know, why have you suddenly said to the world, we're going to have a load of cheeses on a pizza? 4? You know, 4 is not a large number. Like, I'm fine if it's just a 1 cheese pizza, that's fine. But if you're going to say this is the cheesiest pizza in the world, then I fully expect 18.
What do you think is your record for cheeses on a pizza? Have you ever put like a brie on there, like a wheel of brie or something?
I never have because I'm a simple Irish girl with simple needs. And actually, 9 times out of 10, a margarita and a can of Diet Coke is my idea of a hot party. So I'm not somebody who goes around putting eggs on pizza and all this kind of witchcraft. But if what you're asking me, Toby, is do I want to go for pizza with you with a big slab of brie in my handbag, then I'll do it because I'm just up for, you know, I'm up for life experiences.
Right. Okay. So we'll do it. We'll definitely do it. Right. And then we'll take multiple cheeses because, of course, what you can do with a pizza is if you halve it, you can essentially turn it into a sandwich and you can just put all the other cheeses and then just close the lid and like multiple cheese pizza sandwich.
I think we're onto something here. Maybe a business.
Or a heart attack.
Maybe we've started a heart attack. Yeah. Or a spin-off podcast about cheese pizza sandwiches. Do you like pizza?
I love pizza. I love pizza. I'm a big pizza fan. Oh, well, I mean, I'm not over 6 foot, but I'm my height pizza fan. Brona, I really hope pizza features during this conversation about your biopic. But before we get into this, is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
No, it's pronounced film, F-I-L-L-U-M, film. We're going to make a film about Brona C. Titley.
Is that, and that's a deal breaker?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, if anyone says they're going to see my biopic or biopic, they're not allowed in. There's a sort of security on the door watching out for anybody who doesn't say, are you going to the film? So I'm sorry to come down so hard on that early doors, Toby, but a girl's got to have principles.
I think you've got to stand up for what you believe in. And of course, it is your film as well. Is everything a film? Is everything at the pictures a film?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I would never have said the word movie growing up. I think maybe I would just say movie a little bit more now, just in a kind of a, there are certain things that feel more like movies than film. But it's one of the kind of Irishisms that, like, I'll never give up. That, like, calling a film, it's just such a cute little pronunciation idiosyncrasy. So I'm gonna say film to my dying day.
Are there other ones that you have stopped saying?
Yeah, good question. Like, I have been in the UK now in London specifically, for, you know, over a decade. And so when I was living with flatmates, like, at drama school, and they would ask where something was, like the tomato ketchup, and I'd say it's in the press, it would absolutely blow their mind. And they'd be like, do we even have a trouser press? What do you mean? And I'd be like, it's in the press. And so essentially we would say press for cupboard. And you can't get away with that after 10. Like, if you're still calling it a press after 10 years in London, then you're not listening to anyone else. So I definitely say press less. I say press less. And all my answers will rhyme on this podcast. And the other one, I suppose we say a lot in Dublin, especially, if you want to ask someone something, you first start by saying, come here to me. So you'll go, come here to me. What time is it? that definitely threw people when I first came over. They would like, you want me to come over there to you before I answer this? Or if you say it on the phone, you go, come here. Are we going to see a film? They'll really be thrown. So I have had to adapt for the Brits.
I really love the idea of telling someone to do something before you ask them a question. Like, do what I say. Now I'm going to ask you a question. And also, did you say come here to me to people in London who you didn't know, and you were going to ask a genuine question, and they sort of reacted to you as if, oh no, what do you mean? Are you going to start kind of like trying to get money out of me, or are you some kind of scammer or something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say it a lot. It was definitely part of my vernacular. I think mostly people would just be confused. They would be like, oh, so sweet, they can't really speak English. No, look at them there. God, I don't know why now I'm coming in so hard on the Brits, having lived here and married one for quite a long time. I think it's just your big English face, Toby, that's thrown me.
I mean, I never realized that I had a big English face. But okay. And the thing is, look, we're fair game. Take your shot, Brona. Take your
Thank
shot.
You.
And you
Thank
have.
You.
And you have.
And I will. And I will continue to.
You're going to make the film.
Yeah.
Right. It's being done. Yeah. Where are you going to have the meeting with the executives to make this film? Are you going to say, come here to me, the place where you want to go? Or do you want it at the swanky offices or the studio? Where would you like to have that meeting?
Oh, I do love a bit of swank. I really do. But I think in this instance, I definitely want it to be, you know, it's going to be a big Hollywood comedy, but I definitely want it to be a co-pro between like a small independent Irish production company and then a big Hollywood studio, because I want that production company to, you know, get the American dollar. I want them to go get that coin, girl. So I think we would have it in Dublin, where I'm from. And there's actually a great film institute in Dublin called the IFI, where I used to go there all the time when I was at university in Dublin for cheesy chips, because they had the best cheesy chips in town. And also you could sit there for 6 hours and no one would move you on. So I think I would take the big Hollywood execs there. I don't think you can book a table, which I also like. I quite like the idea of us all just standing in the hallway until one big enough for the meeting party opens up. And then we would just sort of have our big meeting around the kind of popcorn eaters and film goers of the city. And I don't think they do cheesy chips anymore. That's the only tragedy in this story, is that I think they took them off the menu. But maybe this will be the thing that brings it back. And maybe they'll put an 18 cheese pizza on the menu when they hear this podcast.
Oh, 18 cheesy chips. 18.
Yeah. Oh, chips. Now he's sucking diesel.
You know what you could do with that then? You could make them, you know, like when you go to craft beer places, they have those flights of beers, the little tasters, you know. I don't know if you kind of have these wooden racks and you have the little beers and you can like have a sip and taste the different beers.
Oh, I see where you're going.
18 different chips with 18 different cheeses on.
I love where your brain's at, Toby. I really, you know, you're a real yes-ander with this cheese chip emporium. And I'm on board. I think we'd have a meeting there.
Do you also like the idea of the studio execs in their I'm assuming here Armani, their Gucci being made to queue up for a table. And like, and also hoping that the cheesy chips are on the menu.
Yeah, I do. I like that. I like the thought of sort of seeing them in the atrium, kind of waiting around. I think out of badness, I just like the, I like taking the wind out of fancy people's sails. So I think it's just like just a little kind of mischievous imp impulse. It's a mischievous imp impulse that I have, and so I think I would feel kind of drunk on power if I knew that I had been greenlit and my life was being turned into a film, and then they were coming to Dublin to meet me because I said come here to me, and I think at that point I would just be seeing how much I could get away with just for the crack.
You said that you like a bit of swank, but you also like the mystery of kind of not taking it or puncturing it a little bit. Do you do that when you go somewhere swanky? Do you go in like wearing flip-flops or something? Do you like to kind of just undercut it a little?
It's really interesting because when I met my now wife, I was going to say my current partner, but that sounds like I was absolutely planning on ditching her ASAP. I made no money, like none. And, you know, she's a company director, so she was doing fine. And so every now and then we would go somewhere fancy for afternoon tea and I would swan in like I absolutely owned the place because I just loved the thought of people thinking I was stinking rich. Whereas she as somebody who is infinitely more successful always felt like a bit out of place because she wasn't somebody who was stinking rich growing up. I've held on to that sort of giddiness at posh places now, even though occasionally I would have to go there for work. And so I think I probably would swan in a t-shirt and flip-flops and then like tell them that their champagne had corked.
I'm just getting this image of you, like you say, swanning around, but with like a champagne coupe always in hand, as if you own it, just waiting for it to be refilled.
Just holding it out to passing punters who don't even work there, just sort of like, bit more, darling. Bit more. Give a top up, please.
that's actually the guy doing the breakfast buffet. And he's just got milk, and he just pours that's milk right. into your coupe.
Yeah, and then I knock it back, and I go, oh,
bit of terrible calcium. Vintage, terrible year, terrible year. Well, exciting news: your life has been greenlit for a biopic. But,
oh my god! Thank goodness.
But how would your life be told by Hollywood and? What sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So the first question, Brona C. Titley, what's the film called?
Oh, these are just all great questions. And this is just a great area. I'm thrilled to be greenlit. I mean, imagine if you'd invited me on the podcast and then said, sorry, no, actually, we're not going to move forward with it this time, but thanks for coming. So many thoughts for the title. So I feel like one option is that we could go with Brona C. Titley, Brona C. My Titley, because I feel like you're a large-breasted woman, as I am, with the word tit in your surname, then, you know, you've got to double down. You got to double D down on that sort of situation. I think this is like a working title that got rejected though, because I don't think it kind of does enough for us. But I think that would have been my first impulse. And
gut instinct is to own it.
Gut instinct.
And fire it out there.
And fire it out. But I don't think we'll go with that. Another thought I had was like Brona C. Titley, toxic positivity. Because having learned that phrase recently, I've never come across anything that sums up my personality and or brand more. I do kind of try and look on the bright side, sometimes to the detriment of the reality of the situation. So I think that would also feature. But then I was talking to one of my best friends a few years ago. We were all kind of having a funny conversation about what like our catchphrases would be if we were a character in something. And you know, you don't have that information about yourself. So I was fascinated and I was like, what do I say? What do I say a lot? And my friend was like, oh, all the time. Your absolute favorite phrase is fair fuck store. And so basically it's a sort of an Irish version of fair play. So instead of like, if someone's doing really well, you would go like, oh, fair fucks to them. I saw they got their own film there. Yeah, fair fucks to them. I see she moved into the big house. Fair fucks to her. I see he his stand-up special is going out on 700 platforms. Fair fucks to him. I think that actually we have to go with that. We have to go with fair fucks to her, because I like to think that the kind of the level of pleasure that I take in other people's success, I'd like them to take the same in mine. So when they see that the film is being made, they could all say, are you going to see Fair Fucks to Her? I mean, Fair Fucks to Her.
That is a brilliant phrase. That is an absolutely amazing phrase.
So glad you like it.
Also, it lends itself to an art house sort of vibe, I think.
Ooh,
Fair Fucks to Her. Yeah. Like, that could be...
Can you do the voiceover, actually?
And I like the pronunciation as well. Your pronunciation is obviously better than mine, because it's got the, you know, it's got the actual, the accent it requires. So the trailer itself...
Well, I'm operating the main... That's what my teacher at drama school used to say. Instead of kind of giving you a line reading, he would say, operate Fox. So the line is to, you know, if he wants you to emphasize something, he would say, operate it. So I think I'm operating the Fox when I say Fair Fox to Her. So I think that's why you prefer the pronunciation. I think if you two operated fucks, then that would work. I don't want to exclude anyone from this film that maybe feels a bit sensitive around cursing. I just like to say that in Ireland we have a different relationship with things that are deemed curse words, because they are a very welcome and integral part of the fabric of an articulate person's life, because there are some words, you know, that you nothing else, no other word will do. So I'm not trying to offend anyone. It just fits. Certainly in my family, my sister and my dad, I mean, my sister is an academic and a lecturer and a very like clever and articulate person. And I never really heard how much we curse until I brought, you know, my English partner and some English family members over, and my sister was making them a salad. And I'll never forget it. It was so funny. She was like, I couldn't find any fucking blueberries for the fucking salad, so I just fucked a few strawberries in there. And I was like, oh, do you know what? Maybe we do curse more than the English now that you say that.
Like Gordon Ramsay. An entire nation.
She would have a very different vibe to Gordon Ramsay now, I would have to say. But, yeah, I suppose there's, in the Venn diagram of language, there's some similarities.
I very much like the idea that, you know, it is not a mark of having a smaller vocabulary or being less articulate, you know, just because you emphasize or stress with a swear word in there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I now have a baby who's 16 months old and sort of, you know, that thing where she sponges up language. And so I do sort of, because I, you know, if she's going around nursery going, oh, she just stuck the triangle in the toy, fair fucks to her. I don't know how the other parents would feel about that. So that's maybe something I'm going to have to interrogate going forward. But at the moment, she only has about 10 words and, you know, she points at everything and calls it a banana. So it's fine for now.
Would you be secretly proud if her first word was fuck?
Not secretly, like outwardly. Shouting from the rooftops proud. Yeah, definitely. I'd look at her and I'd point at her and I'd say, fair fucks to her. So it would all work out in the end.
Just going back to something you mentioned earlier, that a work in progress title, or one you thought about, Brona C. Titley, Toxic Positivity.
Yes.
Toxic Positivity. I don't think I've heard that before. What's that, and why is that you?
So I think that toxic, like, say the definition of toxic positivity were if you were like, Brona, I'm really struggling with my mental health at the moment. And I was like, well, look on the bright side, you know, you're still here. And why don't we go for a nice walk? And sure, you know, it'll all work out. I think that's the actual definition of toxic positivity. I don't think my positivity is quite like that, because I, you know, I am able to recognize when people don't want to hear look on the bright side. But I think that in terms of my desire to always be quite positive and optimistic and cheerful, that is maybe sometimes bordering on toxic, because I think it's also okay to go, no, you know what, things are quite shit at the moment. I'm allowed to be kind of grumpy if I want to. Whereas I always put pressure on myself to, because I think I believe that I'm essentially just unbelievably lucky. You know, I have an incredible family, both the one I came from and the one I have now. I, you know, my job is to write jokes. Like, what an unbelievable privilege it is to wake up in the morning, write a few jokes and get paid for it. And so I think sometimes when I am feeling tired or stressed, and then I suddenly have this toxic positivity voice in my head going like, oh, you shouldn't feel that, you're very lucky. So I think there's probably an element of it. But I think I just liked it as a kind of setting the tone for the comedy, because I quite like that, you know, that Leslie Knope character in Parks and Recreation, where yeah. she's just always this sort of like this life force of like hope and ambition and positivity, but also compassion and friendship and love. And like out of all the kind of characters in TV, I think I identified with her the most. And so I think if the film was called Toxic Positivity, you would kind of get a little, I like it when a film tells you what you're coming to see. And so you would kind of get a little preview of what that would be like. I think that's why it sort of was on the list as a working title.
And you know, Leslie Knope, a great joke in her name, her surname is the only piece of negativity in her, like, which I always really loved that joke. And also I was wondering as well, have you started to care, not care more, that's the wrong way of looking at it. Like a lot of people sort of, you know, maybe they get gloomy and as they get older, they get a bit happier maybe because they kind of just like letting go of things. Are you going the other way? Are you actually going to go, actually, no, I'm going to be less happy. I'm going to be less optimistic.
Yeah. Now that you say it, that's exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. Sort of making more space in my life for not having to be the most cheerful person in the room all the time. Yeah.
So I've got to make space in my life for misery. I just haven't had enough. And I think it's about time I explored a life with more misery.
Yeah, I like the idea of being at like a, I don't know, like a wellness weekend or something, and they're going around the circle and everyone's like saying what they want more in life, and everyone's like more positivity, more confidence, more happiness, and they come to me and I'm like, I want to be miserable.
And also, I mean, would someone who's less toxically positive, they wouldn't say fair fucks to her them as much, would they? Would they say
that's true,
no fucks to them? Would they?
Yes, yeah.
Unfair fucks to them.
I think it's related to zero fucks. Like if you have zero fucks to give about something, then you really don't care about it. Which is a phrase I do quite like using. You know, if my wife is asking me something about the dishwasher, I'll just be like, oh, let me just check my pocket to find out how many fucks I give about this. Oh, no, it turns out absolutely zero. So knock yourself out. Do you know, I do have to say, we are talking about my life now, so I might as well be honest about my personality. And I do think that I don't totally have the kind of jealous gene. So like when I see people doing well, I actually believe that that helps everybody else do better, you know, rather than there being a limited amount of success out there. And if someone does well, yep. you know, it means you'll do worse. I think I believe the opposite. And so I'm quite proud of that, really, because I think like jealousy can really get you if you kind of give into it. Whereas I would always be so excited if friends or loved ones are kind of getting opportunities that I may even want, but I think I'll still enjoy it for them. Yeah, I think I find it inspirational rather than, you know, annoying.
So we've got the title, and I'm intrigued now as to know what the opening scene will be, because we've yeah. spoken about being really upbeat. We've also spoken about wanting more misery in your life. So the the opening scene, the fair fucks to her. How do we enter the Brona C. Titley film?
A good one. I mean, I don't know that it would be, you know, me clutching my sled rosebud to my chest. But I do like the idea of actually it not being something going back in time, that maybe we go forward in time.
Ooh.
And I'm sort of like 100 and I'm being looked after by my robot maid. And I know I'm on the way out, and I kind of grab her by her metal neck and sort of say, tell my story. And then she kind of goes off to there's no library, but she goes to her mind palace where she can look up details about my life. And then it's her about trying to be a screenwriter writing the Brona C. Titley Fair Fucks to Her film. So I would enjoy that. That would be a good start, because then we kind of know where we are. But then also it is fun to just like pick a kind of on brand moment in your life. So I did have a moment when I was a teenager that I remembered recently that really amuses me. I was in school. I was probably about 16 or 17. So I'd very much come into my personality of just joking around all of the time. So just like turning every opportunity into joking. And we were in the library that was separated by a partition. And in one part, those computers, and in the other part, there was sort of desks for studying. And I was in the desks for studying part with the librarian. And a whole heap of teachers, like 30 of them, all came into the computer part because they were having a course on how to use the computers. And they were joking and laughing and chatting. And the librarian looked really worried because there was students studying. And she was like, oh, God, they're going to be very loud. I hope they keep it down. And in my head, I saw a great opportunity for a joke. So I went to the librarian. Don't worry, I'll take care of this. So I went to the partition, stuck my head between it so that the teachers would just see a sort of floating Brona C. Titley head. And I said, excuse me, everybody, do you mind keeping it down? Some people are trying to work in here. And then I paused for the laugh. And all I saw was 30 extremely angry faces staring back at me. They just thought I was being serious. And I did not on any level envisage that as a possibility. And I remember saying to a teacher I got along with quite well the next day, I was like, did the teachers know I was joking? And she was like, well, I think the ones who know you knew you were joking, but there was also 30 other teachers in there who you had just told to shut up as a student. And then you kind of disappeared. And so, no, I don't think they got the joke. So I think that was a good lesson in context.
And your head just vanished, like it was literally a head and it just vanished again.
Yeah. And then the librarian looked absolutely mortified and was like, I hope they don't think I told you to say that. And I kind of like laughed, shrugged it off, and then just died a little bit inside.
So some of the teachers there knew you, yeah. Others didn't. Were any long-held grudges by teachers formed from that incident towards you? Did you then receive static from then on in from certain teachers who took you, that they kind of decided they didn't like you?
I don't think so. I was such a good girl, Toby. Like, I was so well-behaved. I was, a deputy head girl. My Achilles heel was if a teacher in class had a good setup for a gag, I wouldn't be able to stop coming in with the punchline. That was the only thing where I was deemed a bit bold, as we say in Ireland, for naughty. Otherwise, I was like the dream student, like a nerd, like an absolute nerd. Like, I'm not saying I was cool. I'm just saying I was not, the teachers liked me.
Is the reason you were deputy, not head girl, is because you couldn't resist making those jokes?
That's one of the reasons. And I would say the other reason was because I was always late. I just could not get up in the mornings when I was a teenager. The thought of getting out of bed was just like, I loved bed. And so I was just had so many late marks on my record. Also, I lived an ages away from the school. I lived like, it would take an hour and a half to get, because of Dublin traffic, it would take like an hour and a half to get to school sometimes. Because I lived in the suburbs, so I went to school in the city centre, and I just couldn't get to school on time. So I think that was that was maybe one of the reasons why it was like, we can't quite hold her up as the beacon of perfection when she actually just is half an hour late every single day.
What was the latest you were ever, do you remember there being a really late time you got to school? Like, were you super, super late and it was because you'd either just been lying in or, you just couldn't be bothered?
Well, it's not usually that I couldn't be bothered. I usually did want to go to school, but I think, especially in my final year, because I actually just thought I should have been, I was 18 and I thought I should have been at university already. And I was still going to a Catholic girls' school run by a nun in the center of town. And so I would come in at 10 or 11 sometimes. And I was deputy girl at this point, deputy girl. I was deputy head girl at this point and just rocking up so late. They didn't appreciate it, actually, I have to say.
Is brazen.
It was brazen. And one time they put me in detention for it. And I was honestly so offended. I was a bit like, do you not know who I am? Like, you're putting me in detention because I'm later than any student who has ever come to this school repeatedly. And you're trying to punish me for that. You're trying to punish me for something I repeatedly do. Did not like it.
Did you not ever think, I know dicey territory, maybe. Did you not ever think to point out, I think you'll find Jesus took 3 days to come back. I've come in 1 to 2 hours late. Doesn't really match. Doesn't compare.
Oh, I wish I had. I wish I had. Can we write that into the film, actually, and pretend it happened? Yeah.
If we even write you in as Jesus, going late to school, maybe.
In a wine pinafore, just a skirt down past his knees. It would look good.
I also really like the idea, the futuristic element at the start. I mean, by the way, I love the idea of the film starting with like a box shaped hole. And you're the first thing is, Brenner see Titley's head going through the game. Can you keep it down, please?
Perfect.
That's a great start. Yeah. But I'm really intrigued by the idea of you grabbing a robot maid by the neck.
Yeah.
which I mean, very sprightly 100-year-old. Have to say, very sprightly, very aggressive 100-year-old grabbing a robot by the neck.
Well, I did get grumpier as we talked about. Yes, so by the time I'm 100, true. I'm going to just be an absolutely raging bitch.
Full of hatred. Black heart and soul. Not even like numerous trips to Pizza Express can fill that soul with happiness no longer.
No,
maybe because pizza doesn't exist anymore and that's why you're angry.
That's true. I was angry because she spilt my gruel. You know, her robot hands shook with fear as she approached me with my morning gruel.
But I love the idea of a robot maid. I also like the idea there of the robot maid kind of just accessing her mind's palace, essentially, you know, going into whatever the internet becomes, the ultranet or whatever the heck it would be. Because there's no romance, is there, in the future? Because there is, you know, libraries probably won't exist. Yeah. And so there's none of that kind of going back to a building where records exist. And have you already mentioned a library, by the way, as, that it's you in the past and you in the future. The libraries don't exist anymore, though. I mean, there must be a way to bring all that together.
Yeah. I mean, now you're thinking like a director. So if I hadn't have already given you the voiceover job, then I would ask you to direct it, but I can't go back on my word.
Because the future's not romantic, is it? The future, when you think about it, it sucks all the romance future.
Well, nobody's writing a dystopian or a utopian future film where actually everything turns out great for the human race, are they? Like, nobody's writing a beautiful earth that has recovered because we've put all the money into planting trees and we've really figured out our political differences and we know how to treat each other on the planet. Nobody's written that yet. So it does tend to be that the version of the future that we see is a bit more bleak.
Yeah, that's it. Your toxic positivity is maybe it is the future. Maybe there is a happier future. Maybe we can think of a happier future on this.
Okay, well, like, I don't want to be greedy here because it's your podcast and you've been very polite. It's very polite to invite me on. But can we do two films, Toby? Can we have Fair Fucks to Her? The big kind of comedy blockbuster that's a bit more sort of like Bridesmaids, kind of glossy, high budget comedy, right?
Yep.
And those, we have Fair Fucks to Her, and then we have Toxic Positivity, that's more, a little bit more lower budget, a bit more art house, and it's the opposite of a dystopian future where I'm telling my story to my robot maid. And I'm sort of, every now and then she'll stop, you know, like a never ending story where the kid stops and goes, wait, grandpa, what's that? Every now and then the maid will be like, sorry to interrupt, Miss Tidley. What is library? And then I'll have to explain.
I'm a huge fan of this. So are we saying Fair Fucks to Her is the big comedy and Toxic Positivity is the story told via the medium of a robot maid who has a bruised
a little dent on her neck. She's put some arnica on it and then been like, oh no, I forget I am robot, and then just sort of had to upgrade herself for 10 seconds.
We'll have two, and what we'll do is we'll weave the conversation into the material for both, and we can kind of like, you know, that you and the listener can decide which one goes where. So we've got the opening scene, I think, to Fair Fucks to Her, which is your head popping in, telling people to keep it down. And that's a strong opening because we're immediately introduced to Brona C. Titley. But who's cast in the lead of Brona C. Titley? Who's playing Brona C. Titley?
So despite the fact that I take every opportunity to cast myself in everything and or other people's things, I don't think it would be me because I like the idea of seeing somebody else do it. I do think I would pop up as a cameo. Like, I think I'd like to play like my sister or like a really funny person Brona meets, and just have a big scene stealing role where I get to like come in for one day and be paid, have a huge appearance fee, but not have to do very much work. So I think, I've always loved Amy Poehler. So I think, I guess, you know, I know she is older than me, but that doesn't matter in this universe. We can cast her for when she was younger. I like Amy Poehler or Kristen Bell, cheerful but smart women. I think one of those would do it for me.
Yeah. And you wouldn't play the robot maid?
That's who I'll play. You nailed it.
Kristen Bell is a name you don't hear often. You know, obviously she sort of came back in The Good Place, didn't she?
Yeah, I think she's a brilliant actress. Like, she's so brilliant. And she was so brilliant in Frozen. Now, I know that it was, I know that it was an animated version of her, but her voice was brilliant. I think she's amazing. Amy Poehler would play me in Fair Folk Stewart.
Right.
And Kristen Bell would play me in Toxic Positivity.
We're creating the Bronacy Titley universe here. The BCT. The BCT.
I know. Marvel are going to be on the phone after this trying to buy the rights, and we're not going to sell.
So what is it about both those women then that kind of represent or you know, have qualities that you admire or think you share?
Well, I think Amy Poehler, I think, is just, she's a great improviser. She's a great yes-ander. You know, the Leslie Knope character, as I talked about before, has that sort of like aggressive optimism, which I really like, and energy, just lots of high energy. They're both kind of high energy actresses, which you know, which would work. And then just Amy Poehler is just a very smart and compassionate person, which obviously I would aspire to. Who doesn't want to be smart and compassionate? You know, in terms of the work that she's doing now and how she's, yeah, how many things she's kind of done in her career in terms of writing, producing, acting, directing, all that kind of jazz.
You mentioned smart and compassionate there. Are they two qualities you always bear in mind when you're writing, whatever the projects might be? Are they always the kind of things that you always want to aspire to be?
That's a great question. I definitely would try to be smart, because I think audiences are very sophisticated now, so you can't actually just churn out any old rubbish and expect them to watch it. So actually, if you know, you need to not patronize them and do a good job. I don't think I ever think about trying to be compassionate when I write comedy, because essentially you're always looking for the butt of the joke. I mean, I try to punch up, but I don't think compassion is something that I keep in mind when I'm writing jokes necessarily, even though I wouldn't say I'm not exactly a dark writer. You know, I'm not writing dark stuff, but it's just not something that's in the forefront of my mind, I think.
Have you ever written like an angry joke about someone, or like a really kind of properly mean joke about someone, and been like, they flipping deserve this, and they're getting it?
I would have to check my Twitter.
That's basically where they go, isn't it? That's basically where everyone's like really mean jokes go, don't they?
Yeah. I think I have maybe fallen into the trap previously of just kind of demonizing politicians that I don't agree with, which is something I'm actually trying to work on. But, you know, sort of falling into the trap of kind of painting the party that you don't agree with as just being one shower of evil arseholes, as opposed to that there might be individuals in there who think they're doing right, even if you don't agree with their policies. So I've definitely probably said some harsh things and use some harsh words or some harsh imagery when talking about certain political parties, but nothing that comes to mind. Sorry, Toby, I don't have an exact answer for you. God, I really failed. Oh, I've really messed up your podcast.
No, because
I'm so sorry.
No, you wrote it popped to my mind, and this wasn't a mean joke, by the way. You wrote one of the all-time great Twitter jokes about The Rock. About
thank you.
About you know, all the muscles, and he can still get beaten by paper. And did he not retweet that? Did he not put it on Insta? He responded, didn't he?
He replied, and he gave it a proper reply as well. It's really funny because I do love Twitter and I love putting jokes out there, but also sometimes you kind of feel the need to do it when you're not quite in the mood. And I remember that morning, and I put out a lot of jokes, and sometimes you put out one where you're like, this is really going to do well. Yeah. And then it gets 2 likes and nobody ever talks about it again. And I remember the morning I tweeted that, I saw The Rock, like, I just, rock, paper, scissors came into my head, and I thought, The Rock, paper, scissors. And then I went to his Instagram, and he had just posted a photo of him looking buff AF. And so I screen grabbed it, and then, as you say, tweeted, oh, so sad, all those muscles, and he can still be beaten by paper. And then it did numbers, like it went really well. And it was like something that I just threw out there because I felt like I had to do a tweet that day. And I can't remember his exact reply, but he was basically like, according to the rock, paper, scissors manual section, this article. That I can't even remember what he said, but he kind of took the joke and ran with it, as opposed to say it was brilliant. It was great. It was so good. That was lovely, because I mean, he is just the biggest movie star on the planet, both in terms of size and earnings. And so it was so weird. I was walking down Walthamstow High Street near where I live, and I saw The Rock reply to me. And it was just so incongruous, because like you watch his Instagram videos of him and his, like, he lives on an estate in California. Like, it's not, you can't even call it a house. It's essentially a town. And then he's tweeting me on Walthamstow High Street. And actually I was working on Spitting Image at the time, and I was writing a lot of The Rock sketches, which is probably why he was on my mind. So that was quite funny that I was sort of like writing for puppet him, you know, then like, you know, watching the episodes where an impressionist was like saying the lines I wrote, and then the actual person was tweeting a reply to a joke I wrote, and you were just sort of like, what is my life? Like, it doesn't, none of this makes sense. Oh, it would make a good film.
He'd also, yeah. I mean, I'm sure he could feature in there as well. I'm sure he would give up time for either Fairfax.
He's already told me he'll do a cameo.
And this brings us on. And I think we've kind of covered this already. But, okay, you know, we're doing two films. What genre would the films be and why? And what sort of budget are we looking at? And I think you'd said Fairfax to Her is going to be the big Hollywood comedy, and Toxic Positivity will be the sort of lower budget, art housey film. Is that what you're sticking with?
I think so, yeah. I love those. I really like those big budget Hollywood comedies like The Hangover or Bridesmaids. So we definitely have to go with that for the first one. And because we're doing two, and I don't have time to do two big blockbuster comedies, the second one is just going to have to be a bit simpler. So I can move on to other projects.
Those big Hollywood comedies, like Bridesmaids, for example.
Yeah.
How hard are they to get right, do you think?
Oh, really, really hard. And actually, I think when they work, it's because you have an auteur, you have a very strong auteur writing them, as opposed to like a room of people, like a committee.
Yeah.
I really loved Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Have you seen that?
That's on the list, but yeah.
Treat yourself, Toby. Get yourself an 18 cheese pizza this weekend and sit down and watch it. And that's actually, it's just so unapologetically, gloriously silly. And I use the word silly with great love, because I think that actually sometimes there's a trend in comedy to not be silly, you know, that you need to be dark or smart or,
yep,
you know, or true to life. And actually, I just love when things are stupid. And Barb and Star is just the ultimate silly film. Like, it's ridiculous. And I loved that. And I would love to channel some of that into Fairfax to Her, because I like kind of a bit of magic realism, a bit of silliness, and then like some human relationships but just gag, gag, gag. I like it to be joke, joke, joke.
This now brings us on. If you want joke, 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 this brings us on to what parts of your life would definitely have to be in there. And why? Ooh. And I'm assuming we start with that joke with you trying to tell the teachers to keep the trap shut and it failing. Which other parts in your life would have to be in Fairfax to Her if it's going to be gag, gag, gag?
To stay in school for a second, a dirty secret of mine is that I was a school's debater. So I debated in school in the Irish language, in English, and also in Spanish, though I can't speak a word of Spanish now. But English, and I don't think I competed in Spanish, but in English and Irish, I definitely did. And I loved acting and drama. My whole life revolved around it. But I think when I was nearing my exams, my parents were a bit like, maybe don't do 7 plays this term. Maybe we should concentrate on the exams a little bit. But a loophole that I saw in that was debating, because for me, debating was still a performance, but to them, it was academic. And so what ended up happening was I won the what's known as the Leinster Schools Debating Championships, which is a sort of big county thing. And then I came second in the All-Ireland competition. And then I became captain of it's so embarrassing, but also so funny. I became captain of the Irish team that went to the World Championships when I was 18. I went to the World Championships of debating. Like, how hideously embarrassing and also hilarious is that? And so it was exactly as you would picture it. Nerds from every country, not every country, but like quite a lot of countries in the world, all meeting in Pittsburgh. It was in Pittsburgh in the States. I think it was my first time in America. It was actually, yeah. And we went to Pittsburgh to various Catholic universities, seemed to be where it was being hosted, and then we competed against it. And it was such a funny time, because I was good at talking, but I also didn't know anything about the world. And you would get, you would have these debates where like it would, you would get the topic an hour before. So you wouldn't really be able to do any research or anything. You would just sort of have to like come up with your arguments. So I would be told an hour before, okay, you're going to debate Pakistan on whether or not there should be harsher punishments for juvenile offenders. And I would be like, okay, let's see how I can work a few jokes into this. But also me and the Irish team, we were essentially there to party, and we were 18, so we could drink in Ireland, but we couldn't drink in the States where it was 21. And we had a big party in our hotel room where we got all of the other countries to come around, and we were all drinking and kissing each other. And then like someone from, I think the Canadian team came panting to the door and was like, I've just seen the cops. They're in the lobby. Like, you've got time before they come up. And then just like all of these international nerds from every country just sort of like split and like went to hide in the shower or ran back to their room or like jumped out onto the balcony. And we were all kind of like pouring alcohol down the toilet. Five armed state troopers came to the door, like five police officers with guns. And I'd never seen a gun in my life before this. And we're like, are you kids having a party in here? And we were like, no, we're just practicing debating. And then they were like, wait, are you Irish? And then we charmed them and they left like singing an Irish ditty. We got away with it. But so I think like my dirty schools debating history would have to be in there.
Oh my God. I just love the idea of like a UN of nerds all in a room,
yes,
having a party.
Exactly.
Which countries were kissing each other? Can you name the countries that were kissing each other?
I kissed a Canadian boy and an Israeli boy. So another teammate, he hooked up with someone from Wales. I remember that. England did actually that. We came 10th in the world in that competition, which was the best Ireland had ever done, actually.
Yeah.
And let's not mention the fact that a few years later, Ireland came and won another an Irish team. I wasn't on one. But England got to the final. So the English team got to the final. I think the final might have been England versus Australia. I could be wrong.
Man.
But it was just such a formative experience. Like, I'll never, ever forget it. And when I went back to do my exams, I had missed loads of time because I had been away for 2 weeks. So I didn't have any information. But what I did have was like the ability to form a very structured argument and confidently answer questions. So even though like I knew nothing, I would still manage to like scrape B's in my exams because I just sounded like I knew things, even though I really didn't.
I'm wondering, did any of those people you went, not necessarily the Ireland team, but you know, some of those nerds, you've described them as nerds, not me. Did any of them go into politics? Did any of them become famous or anything?
Oh, good question. I mean, there was, so the schools debating feeds into university debating, and then that feeds into politics hugely. I jumped off the ship after schools debating because once I went to university, I went to Trinity College in Dublin. There's a theatre there, the student theatre called Players, and all I wanted to do was put on plays every minute of every day. So I didn't have time for the debating societies. So, I mean, the truthful answer is that my sister, who was the auditor of one of these famous debating societies, was in the debating society around the same time with a guy who did go on to be the Taoiseach of Ireland, which is our prime minister. So, yeah, like literally, yeah, a lot of them went into politics.
Wow. And have your views on punishment for juvenile offenders changed over the years? Did Pakistan
lock them up?
That is an amazing tale. That is such a great tale. Here's a question though. I mean, if you said you admitted you kissed an Israeli boy there. If there was a Palestinian boy there, and you'd kiss the Palestinian boy, could you have not then acted as a mediator in some way and then maybe brought about peace in the Middle East?
And this is what keeps me awake at night, Toby. And it's like, it's only like, and I already thought that maybe I was pushing the boundaries of my reputation by kissing two boys in the same 5-day period. And if I had just managed to kiss a third or a girl, I mean, I didn't actually like girls at that point. I hadn't really discovered them yet. But if I had just managed that, then yeah, I could have done that. And instead I've let everybody down. I've let myself down.
This, sorry to interrupt, but this could be the toxic positivity storyline, that you're the alternative timeline where,
yeah,
through debating and a nerd party
and kissing, debating and kissing, she changes the world.
Peace in the Middle East. I mean,
it's not where I thought the film was going to go, but that, sometimes you have to listen to what the people want.
Well, I just love the absolute, like, I mean, it's stereotypical. It's literally lifted from films and television over and over again. The idea of a bunch of nerds pouring booze down the drain just because the cops are coming. It's just so comically wasteful.
We were such nerds. And I did also do, we don't have to talk about it because I feel like this podcast will be 7 hours long, but I did also do Model United Nations, which is exactly, you know, the kind of, I also did that. So I went to MUN conferences around the UK and Ireland as well, as well as the World Debating Championships. I mean, my whole school career was just being a professional nerd, and I loved it.
Now, I like the fact that you said, like, this is your dirty secret, that you're a debater, that you're a debater. So I'm wondering if that's going in and the Model UN is going in as well, which parts of your life aren't going in? Which moments from your life are on the cutting room floor?
It's hot. Like, I did have a string of money jobs that you take on while you're trying to make it as an actor, as a comedy writer, but I actually think they'd all be quite funny because I worked as like a Christmas elf and a princess and various things, so I think they'd probably go in. But the one thing that probably wouldn't, I don't think it has any place in a comedy, was maybe like my horrendous labor when I gave birth to my daughter and just was fully convinced I was gonna die. I think probably like we would try to make it work with a bit of dark comedy maybe, but then it, ultimately the director would be like, I think we need to cut this. It's not really in tone with the rest of the film. And I'd be like, fine.
How bad was it? Was it really bad?
Well, it's interesting because sort of like, I mean, a midwife said to me afterwards, any vaginal birth is a traumatic birth, which is quite apt, but also quite funny because, you know, people call a vaginal birth a natural birth, you know, even though all births are natural, I would say. But it was just the pain. And actually, like, I do want people to know this a little bit. And not, if you're pregnant, maybe just skip the next 30 seconds. But if you're not pregnant, like, you or haven't been or don't plan on getting, then you need to know that actually, like, you potentially haven't felt pain like this. I mean, I know the old argument of like, well, you know, people who give birth usually haven't been kicked in the testicles, so how do we know? But I thought I had a high pain threshold. And for the first kind of 24 hours of labor, I was like, okay, this is painful, but I can get on with it. And then it kicked up a notch, and it was just like someone was slicing open my back with a sharp knife for 45 seconds and then taking like a 45 second break and then starting again. And I remember going from like, I can handle this to the absolute cliche, like, I need an epidural now, like refusing to move from the table where I'd just been examined, like refusing to go to the waiting room, just absolutely screaming at everyone around me to immediately give me drugs, like proper cliche, like, drugs now.
Did they supply drugs now?
Yeah, they gave me some gas and air, and then later on in the process I did have an epidural, and I will never not be grateful as long as I live. The difference between gas and air, you're still feeling the pain, but you kind of care less because you're high. So you're sort of going like, oh, I'm in excruciating pain, that's mad, isn't it, as you sort of hover above it a little bit. But with the epidural, it actually does stop the pain, and so you're like, oh, okay. I mean, it's so interesting because I passionately wanted to be pregnant and give birth, and it was a privilege and a pleasure, and my daughter is by far the best human being who has ever existed in the history of humanity. But labor is a cunt. So I think probably that would be on the cutting room floor, no pun intended, with the fact that they had to cut me to get her out.
I mean, it sounded like it was a long labor. If you're 24 hours and then it went up a notch. That's
It was 36. Just like, imagine being just an excuse. And it's so interesting as well, because like, if someone, you know, if people we know are in a horrific car accident where they're in excruciating pain for 3 days, you sort of recognize that that's a trauma and then treat them really gently for the rest of their lives. With labor, people go, ah, did you have a tough one? Ah, God love you. God love you, you had a tough one, yeah.
Is that it? Is it kind of the war story thing then? With other mothers, you know, when you hear people sharing war stories, that's what you're doing. That's the way people kind of deal with what's happened and what's taken place.
Yes, and I never wanted that. I didn't want to have a war story. I spent the whole of pregnancy being really positive and doing my hypnobirthing breathing and trying to believe that actually I would have a lovely birth. That's what I kept telling myself, my brain. you're actually going to have a lovely birth. And it turns out that that was very far from the truth.
Well,
cut, edited out of the movie.
Right, that's out. And that brings us on to the influences on this film. I'm guessing One Born Every Minute won't be one of the influences on Fair Fucks to Her, because that ain't in there. That ain't being shown.
Yeah, and especially if it's like one born every 36 hours. Yeah. One born every minute. I mean, if it was just 1 minute, fine. Influences. So I've already talked a bit about like Barb and Star, Bridesmaids, The Hangover, that kind of thing. So I think what we need now is to throw in some Irishisms.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like, I'm recently watching Frank of Ireland on Channel 4, actually, and I love it because it's got that silliness that I talked about.
Yep.
And definitely up there for me with iconic kind of dark Irish humor is In Bruges with Colin Farrell. Oh, do you remember that film?
Yeah.
So I love that film. My sister and I quote that all the time. There's a moment in the film where Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell are just on a boat, and it's beautiful going down like the canal in Bruges. And Colin Farrell just looks at Brendan Gleeson and goes, "Do you think this is good?" It's just perfect Dublin cut down. So I love a bit of that. So I think the big kind of Hollywood comedy budget shininess meets a bit of sort of Irish deadpan humor. I think we'd be onto a winner.
Hollywood, you know, does like Ireland, and there's a lot of love in the States, obviously, for Ireland and for Irish creative arts. Does it annoy you? Do you see things in, you know, American TV and film about Ireland or Irish people which kind of annoys you because it's so wide off the mark, or it's a cliche that kind of gets repeated a lot?
You know, I think I used to when I was younger. Now that I sort of work in TV and I understand comedy, I think sometimes you do, that's the first place that you go to is stereotypes and cliches and stuff, because they're recognizable and they're fun and they're tropes that you can immediately take the piss of. Like I remember when Saoirse Ronan hosted SNL and she did a sort of an Aer Lingus parody. And everyone in Ireland was up in arms about it. And I was like, I thought it was really funny. Like, it's, just, you know, it's like, you don't know much about us, but why don't we take the piss out of the stuff that they do know? And I remember I got torn apart online when I wrote a Irish sketch in Tracy Ullman's show. And it was about Brexit. And I sort of made out that like Irish people were profiting off Brexit by selling Irish passports. And people just really didn't like it because it was on the BBC, because Tracy Ullman was doing an Irish accent, and because they just didn't know that an Irish person had written it. So they thought it was the English people taking the piss out of the Irish. It's such a funny relationship we have with it in Ireland, because we kind of love taking the piss and we love the piss being taken out of us as individuals, but we don't like the piss being taken out of Ireland. And so you can sometimes, there's a bit of tension there.
And so would Fair Fucks to Her, would it play on those tropes and stereotypes that you mentioned in order to be as wide as possible?
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely.
And I just sorry to skip back a bit there. You mentioned about the Tracy Ullman sketch that you wrote that got a bit of heat.
Yeah.
How did that kind of, how did that filter down to you and the rest of the team on the show? Like, did you all speak to each other when it kind of was getting a bit of a bad press?
So I wrote that, I co-wrote that sketch with Tony Cook, who is my writing partner sometimes on certain shows and a wonderful man and writer who I adore. So we had written that together, but we had written it because I was an Irish woman who, you know, who pitched it. But at the time, I think there was another writer who got, because we had some Corbyn sketches in the show, I think there was way more heat on him and on those sketches, because of the way that people felt about Corbyn at the time, which was that if you loved him, you really loved him. And if you hated him, you really hated him.
Yeah.
So I don't think anyone I don't think anyone was too bothered. And also it was more of an Irish Twitter storm than a UK Twitter storm. So I don't think anyone in the team really was that bothered.
Does that ever, when you work on shows, particularly?
I was a bit embarrassed though, sorry, Toby, just because you hate the thought that you've crossed the fence and taken the soup. So I hated anyone thinking that I was now in England taking the piss out of Irish people, as opposed to the fact that actually I really wanted to see an Irish sketch in the show. I was aiming for representation. So that one didn't go quite according to plan.
Does that kind of thing stick with you, you know, as you can continue writing? Do those kind of reactions stick with you? You know, you go into another thing. Obviously, writing for Spitting Image, of course, you know, the job is to satirise.
That's true.
Does that reaction kind of stick with you when you go into it? Is it in the back of your mind, or do you just forget it and move on?
I think you have to forget it and move on, because you can't write comedy wondering how it'll impact people. I mean, you need to have a little eye on it, especially if you're doing something where you want to be responsible about the type of comedy you're putting out into the world. Like I talked earlier about punching up rather than punching down and stuff. So I think you need to have a little eye on it, but you can't think, oh no, we can't say that because it'll send this sect of people on Twitter off. You just sort of have to try and be responsible in the sketch that you are doing the right thing. Like in that instance, for me, the butt of the joke was Brexiteers. But Irish people felt they were being kind of taken the piss out of. And I was in the sketch. I had a little cameo in the sketch. And someone online was like, oh my God, the Irish accents are terrible. And I was like, no, I definitely know that I'm Irish. Like, you can say what you want. You can say what you want about my writing, but I think my accent is okay.
But that's fascinating because, of course, you know, again, writing on Spitting Image, what do you have to rein yourself in sometimes, particularly because it's political and it's satire?
So I think in a way that's the showrunner's job. You should try and be as bold as you can if you're satirizing something, and then it's up to the lawyers and the producers and the showrunners to say, no, that one's libel, we probably won't put that one out.
Was there anything in Spitting Image that you were surprised made it through?
Well, I wrote this sketch really early doors about Priti Patel being a kind of a dominatrix, but her kink was just saying really nasty things. as in, like, no, the kink that she specialized in. So, like, the sketch is Michael Gove going to her to hear her say things that everyone else is thinking, but she's the only one who will say.
I remember
Oh, I love that sketch. I really, really like it. And I think Priti Patel is a good target. And so I was surprised that made it in, actually, really, because, you know, she was kind of a dominatrix with a whip, and Michael Gove was wanking in the bed, and I had her say all sorts of terrible things. But also, I think that's what satire should do. Like, that was one of my favorite sketches in the show, because for me, that's the right type of satire.
Absolutely. No, I remember that. And it is, you know, with Spitting Image, it's taking an aspect of someone's character you believe to be true or kind of is immediately sort of like visible, and then boom, just pushing it, maxing
it out.
That's
exactly right. That's exactly right. There has to be a seed of truth, or else it's not funny, actually. Because then you're just sort of lost in this kind of surreal place of whimsy.
And so talking about feedback, Brenda, if the critics love Fair Fucks to Her or Toxic Positivity, or hate Fair Fucks to Her or Toxic Positivity, how would that affect you and your next project? Would it affect you and your next project? Has it ever affected you?
So I think that that's very dependent on A, whether I was very hands on the whole time, or actually I just took my payday and left. Depending on what it is, I'm quite big picture. Like, I think if you write something well, cast it well, crew it well, then actually you can let everybody else do their jobs well and then kind of come in for the important stuff. I don't like to get lost in tiny detail about the cadence with which they emphasize one of the words in the sentence.
Right.
So if I feel like it had been written well and then everyone was doing their jobs well, it sort of doesn't matter what everybody else thinks. Also, if there was an option that actually, like, I had lived this great life, it was now a film biopic, and they had bought the rights, I would probably also just say, do what you want and go to the Maldives before it sinks so that I can see it and just have a holiday with all my loved ones. And just let them get on with it. And if I'd done that, I think I wouldn't care what the critics had said. But I think if I liked it, yeah, I would probably want people to like it. But it definitely wouldn't affect my next project, because you just have to stand up, shake yourself off and crack on, because, you know, what other option do you have, I suppose?
I mean, is that something you've learned through your career? Or like you say, you like putting on plays at university and, you know, you and at school, then university. You know, when you're young and you're doing that, That can feel quite personal.
Oh God, yeah. I feel like if I had a bad performance as an actor in a play at university, and I think the audience didn't get it or they didn't like me, I would just feel it for like 6 months afterwards. I would carry it around.
Oh man.
And I think when I started comedy writing, I think I also would like check Twitter and desperately need everyone to like everything I work on. And I think the more you do it, the more you realize that that's just not how social media works. It does become easier, and you can sort of see criticism and be like, fine, if you think that's true, fine, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I think if it was like, you know, my work baby, And I have, you have a few projects that are sort of like, you know, you do because you're working, and few that are your soul. I think if it was one of the ones that was my soul, I wouldn't be able to take any criticism. I'd be hiding in the press crying.
Your soul and body would be at Pizza Express or in the press. Yeah,
that's right. Shoveling dough balls. But I think it's weirdly, I find it easier to separate myself from my writing than I do to separate myself from acting. Because if someone doesn't like your acting, they're seeing so much more of you. You know, they're sort of seeing your face and your hair and your body and your voice. And whereas if they don't like your writing, they kind of don't like something that just once came out of your brain. Like, fine, I throw a lot of shit out there. That's fine. That's your prerogative.
Oh man, well I know how it feels now, you know, what with my big English face and
yes, you know. And it's funny that I said that actually as a joke at the start, because you actually look a bit Irish.
I do have, as you know, most people do, a bit of Irish in my family, so is it the fact that I look extremely sun averse?
Yes, that's it, that's what did it.
I basically,
I know, it's also the mischievous twinkle in your eye, Toby.
Now we're talking. Now you're treating me like a state trooper busting up a nerd party.
I'd love if that was a phrase. Hey, come on, treat me like a state trooper busting up a nerd party.
Oh man, I'm gonna work that in somewhere if you don't first.
Oh, I love it. I'll listen to everything you do from now on just to make sure that you,
I will have to
make
sure
that you're using that phrase.
I have to co-credit you on it, so I mean, like, you will get a notification. Now at the very start we said, you know, you said you want to take the studio executives to the IFI where they wouldn't be served cheesy chips because they're currently not on the menu.
Yes.
Where would the premiere of Fair Fucks to Her or Toxic Positivity take place, and who's invited?
Okay, well, I mean, in keeping with my greedy, grabbing personality where I made you do me two films, there has to be like a Dublin, London, New York and LA premiere.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And they'll have different vibes, but I will go to all of them. And with my champagne flute, I will keep the same champagne flute gripped in my hand as the jet takes me between them. I'm kind of simultaneously mortified to think that anyone would ever think I'm a fan of anything, and also a massive fan of things. And so I love the kind of cordoning off Leicester Square with the railings to keep the screaming people at bay while the red carpet is down to go into the Odeon there. Like, I do love that kind of forced glitz. We would definitely have to do one of those.
It's forced. It's forced, yeah. All right. I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, but there's a hype man. Have you been to one of those?
I think so, yeah. Or I might be mixing it up with the BAFTAs, which I have been to. Just needed to drop that in there, actually.
What did you do at the BAFTAs? What did you wear? What was the deal? Who did you hang out with? Who were you sat next to? Did anyone eat canapes weirdly?
Yes to all of that. No, I wrote part of the script for the TV BAFTAs one year, and once for the film BAFTAs, I think, just little segments.
Yeah.
So I got to go as a writer. And then another time I went as Aisling Bea's date, which was very fun. We had a nice evening. And did I see anybody? I met Mary Berry the time that I wrote the citation scripts, and I had to go and like brief her about the joke in her little thing. And then she looked at the joke I'd written. I can't remember what it was. And she was like, I'm not going to say that. That's a bit cheesy, isn't it? And I was like, yes, it is, Mary. You're absolutely right.
Too cheesy for Mary Berry.
It was too cheesy for Mary Berry. I mean, and that is what will go on my gravestone.
That must have been that must have been a bit crushing for Mary Berry. Not known for her comedy stylings. Mary Berry.
No, true. And I think maybe that's what it was that she just didn't maybe want to say a joke. But in answer to your question about who would be there, like, I just love the idea of inviting like literally everyone I've ever met. Or at least everyone I've ever been like a little bit pally with. Because I remember this moment at my wedding. I got married 4 years ago now, and we had a big-ish wedding in the Lake District. It was sort of big by English standards, but small by Irish standards. It was 120 people. But the moment that myself and my wife walked into the ceremony together, it was one of the most beautiful moments of my life, because I didn't realize that when you walk into your wedding, everybody there is someone that you love. Like every single person. And it felt like a film, actually. It felt like the bit at the end of the film where you see all of your favorite characters come back together at some concert or something. And so, you know, it was, even though I should have been looking at my wife and excited about marrying her, I was excited about the guests, because it was sort of like we were kind of walked through the hall, like, and then up the aisle. So we got to pass all of them. And it was just sort of like shining face that I love after shining face that I love. I love having big parties and seeing lots of people that I like in the same room. It's one of my favorite things, actually, is to hear the people that I love sing and see lots of people that I love in the same room. So I think the premiere of this would be a good opportunity to get them all together, just so I can look at them.
Just so you can look at their shiny faces.
Exactly.
The pandemic must have been quite hard if that's kind of the way you are, like being someone who loves lots of people in the room and big parties.
Well, I'm a textbook extrovert. So yeah, it's been really weird. And also it's the longest I've gone without being to Ireland. It's the longest I've gone without seeing my family.
Yeah.
My baby was born a month before the pandemic started.
Oh,
so
gosh.
She has met very few people, a few more now that we can meet outdoors and stuff. So that was really tough, but also we were still very privileged because I was on maternity leave for the start of it. And then I was able to work from my bedroom for the rest of it.
Yeah.
You know, we had a small garden. We live in Walthamstow where there's loads of green spaces. So I felt like in terms of how pandemics could have gone, I had an okay one. And the first 6 months you kind of hunker down with a baby anyway. It's just that we just haven't been out. Like I've been out 3 times in 17 months, like in terms of in the evening. I haven't been out in the evening. You know, I like to go to the theater and the cinema and friends' houses and dinner parties a lot. So yeah, I didn't enjoy that part.
And this obviously is going to be a brilliantly glitzy and glamorous affair, the premiere. Yeah. But who isn't invited, Brona C. Titley?
And
why? For example, are the Canadian and Israeli debaters, formative snogs of your youth, are they invited?
They were both good kissers, but I couldn't remember their names if you paid me. So no, and probably many of the people that I've kissed won't make the cut.
Sorry to interrupt, Brenda, but please tell me some of the debates at this international convention were like, this house believes Canadians are the best kissers, or think that.
This house believes you should swallow. Yes, they were. Just for you, they were.
Fantastic.
Who isn't invited?
Who isn't invited? So
I have a relatively short shit list, but there's definitely, I do enjoy the thought of putting a few, you know, when someone wrongs you, it's quite fun to put them on your mental enemy list. I worked in a restaurant in Dublin as a waitress when I was in university, and I was fired for being too friendly to the customers.
What? Really?
For like chatting too much and being too pally, I was fired. So definitely the sour-faced, bitter, mean old manager that fired me for being too friendly, he's not invited. So he can suck it. I was based off one day where the cafe was entirely empty except for one person by himself who was fine, and then an English couple who were visiting Dublin and wanted some recommendations. So I stood by their table and chatted to them for like 15, 20 minutes. Nobody else was in the cafe, and the manager stood watching me the whole time. And then when I came back to the bar, he just absolutely went through me for doing that. And I was like, they literally wanted it. So he's not coming. Any comedy writers who don't let other comedy writers finish their sentences, they're not invited. That's a really bad habit in comedy writers' rooms, where like you go, you say the setup for a joke, and then another comedy writer comes in and crashes your punchline. They can stay at home.
Is there like a drop in the temperature in the room when someone does that? Does everyone know that's not done?
I think it depends on how the room is run. If you have someone running the room saying, look, we're not going to try and finish each other's sentences, we're not going to tell anyone their idea doesn't work, where if we don't agree with something, we can try and beat it, and we're going to laugh and enjoy ourselves, then you'll have set the tone well. What you have sometimes in writers' rooms is writers who no longer like comedy. So you'll say something really funny and they'll be like, yeah, I guess that could work. Yeah. And you're like, oh, you stopped laughing 10 years ago. It's so sad. I'm so sorry for you.
time to change. Time to change career.
Time's up.
That's the case.
Time's up.
Well, Brona C. Titley, congratulations on Fair Fucks to Her and Toxic Positivity, starring Amy Poehler
so
and Kristen Bell. featuring an international debate team party broken up by cops, multinational snogging, school debating, the UN World Debating Championships, I think they're in there as well, along with a sweary salad and a joke too cheesy for Mary Berry. Bronissy Titley, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you. See you at the premiere because you are invited.
Yes. Yes.